Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider. Today, we will be reading the following main reviews. 5 Books to Help You Understand the Economy Before Voting. The Absinthe Forger, A True Story of Deception, Betrayal, and the World's Most Dangerous Spirit. No One Gets to Fall Apart, A Memoir. And following up with other miscellaneous reviews. 5 Books to Help You Understand the Economy Before Voting. The brightest minds explore the issue at every level, from the levers that control inflation to the best way to achieve work-life balance. The reviewer is Jason Furman. Jason Furman is a professor of economic policy at Harvard University. Voters are forever worried about the economy, the price of homes and groceries, the rise and fall of the stock market, and of course, taxes. But the economic policies that affect these things often seem unapproachable. Donald Trump wants to cut taxes and raise tariffs. Kamala Harris wants to raise taxes on high-income households and expand the social safety net. But what does that mean, and what are they hoping to achieve? Part of what makes economic policy difficult is the need to understand not just the direct impact of a change, but also its many indirect effects. A tax credit to buy houses, for example, might end up benefiting home sellers more than home purchasers if a surge in demand drives up prices. The mathematics and jargon that economists use in journals facilitate precise scientific communication, which has the indirect effect of excluding everyone else. Meanwhile, the economists you see on TV or hear on the radio are more often telling you, usually incorrectly, whether the economy will go into recession without explaining why. But some authors do a good job of walking the line between accessibility and expertise. Here are 5 books to help you crack the nut on the economy before Election Day. First book, The Little Book of Economics by Greg Ip. The best way to understand things like the causes of recessions and inflation and the consequences of public debt is to take an introductory economics course and do all the problem sets. The second best way? Read The Little Book of Economics. Don't be fooled by its compact form and breezy writing. This book, by the Wall Street Journal economics commentator Greg Ip, manages to pack in just about everything you wanted to know but were afraid to ask about the gross domestic product. Ip is not trying to sell you policy recommendations. Instead, he is just trying to teach you the mainstream economic perspective. Suddenly, you will know why the Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell looks a little nervous when he tells the press that the neutral rate of interest might have gone up. The book does contain one obvious misstatement. It should be the little book of macroeconomics. For more of the rich diversity of what economic studies has to offer at other scales, you might want to also consider what's below. Second book, Career and Family, by Claudia Golden. Nothing is more scarce than our time. Everyone, no matter how rich or how poor, still only has 24 hours in their day. And perhaps no choice is more difficult than the trade-off between time with family and time working. For instance, I'm doing this work as my 9-year-old sits in the other room, being babysat by what sounds like a rather uneducational YouTube video. This choice has been even harder for women, which is one reason that Kamala Harris has been campaigning on creating a better care economy, including increased tax benefits for people with children, something J.D. Vance has nodded to as well. Claudia Golden, a Nobel Prize-winning economist, and my colleague at Harvard, has a more expansive view. She has devoted her career to studying the history of inequality in labor, especially when it comes to women in the workforce. In Career and Family, she describes how shifts in technology, cultural attitudes, and institutions have reshaped women's relationship to work and family. Golden argues that these days, true pay and employment discrimination, while they matter, are relatively small. Men and women are typically paid similar amounts for similar jobs. Then children come into the picture, and the kinds of jobs men and women take diverge. This disparity is especially stark in what Golden calls greedy jobs, which demand lots of time at unpredictable hours, think investment bankers, and pay a higher amount per hour as a result. She is frank that some of this might be unavoidable for heterosexual couples, so long as gender norms around child rearing persist, and is in favor of subsidizing child care. But she also wants more institutions to divide up work and make it more predictable. One example, decades ago, more obstetricians were men. Many of them operated as solo practitioners who had to be available 24/7 because a baby could come at any time. Today, obstetrics is generally a group practice where everyone has predictable hours and, surprise, surprise, the field is now increasingly dominated by women. Golden urges us to ask what else could work this way, and it behooves us all to find out. Designing more jobs that work well for moms might just have the unintended effect of creating a better labor market for everybody. Next book, We've Got You Covered, by Liren Aynav and Amy Finkelstein. Perhaps no economic issue is more important than health care. Around 1/6 of the U.S. economy is devoted to providing health care, far more than any other developed country, and yet life expectancy is still the lowest of the world's advanced economies. The Affordable Care Act greatly expanded health insurance coverage, but some 30 million Americans still do not have it. Liren Aynav and Amy Finkelstein are two of their generation's leading health economists. In 2012, Finkelstein won the John Bates Clark Award, second in prestige only to the economics Nobel. Still, in 2019, when Finkelstein's father-in-law asked her what she would do to solve the problems of the healthcare system, she could not immediately answer. Instead, she teamed up with Aynav, and they spent years writing a book proposing the government automatically enroll every American in a system of universal basic coverage, a no-frills floor that people could add to if they wanted. You do not need to buy Aynav and Finkelstein's solution to get a lot out of their book, which goes from first principles, why should the government do anything about health insurance, through an analysis of the shortcomings of the current system. Aynav and Finkelstein are upfront. Everyone would be covered, but unless they kicked in more of their own money, or unless their employers did, the result would be very bare bones, more focused on what is needed for better health than shorter waiting times and greater choice of doctors. Their plan is unlikely to become a reality in the next several years, no matter who wins the election. But it is good that at least some economists are heeding Milton Friedman's advice that they should not tailor their ideas to what the political system thinks possible now, but instead to what it should think possible in the future. Fourth book, Free Trade Under Fire, by Douglas A. Irwin. Douglas A. Irwin first published this defense of global commerce in 2002, following protests like the Battle for Seattle, whose participants decried the rise of the World Trade Organization. Many of the demonstrators were worried that globalization was exploiting workers in both rich and poor countries. Irwin's book, now in its fifth edition, has been updated to reflect the current backlash against trade. Higher tariffs have been justified by claims that they will be paid by foreigners, help American workers, and even ultimately help American consumers. Irwin debunks these widespread narratives. For example, he shows that the vast majority of job loss in recent decades has more to do with automation than trade. He also provides evidence to show that tariffs do not reduce trade deficits. When goods made overseas are taxed at higher rates, less stuff moves around the globe. But less efficient domestic factories also can't keep up with the new demand. As a result, the imbalances continue, hurting both consumers who would otherwise benefit from affordable imports and workers whose jobs are tied to exports. You think prices at the store are high now? Try shopping during a trade war. And the final book, The Lady's Paradise by Emile Zola. Republican and Democratic voters alike are increasingly skeptical of corporate power. Experts are more divided. The two poles of the debate are well captured by the economist Tyler Cowen's Big Business, A Love Letter to an American Anti-Hero, and the legal scholar Tim Wu's The Curse of Business, Antitrust in the New Gilded Age. As a fiction reader, I love many novels that depict corporations exploiting workers. As an economist, I was curious whether any novelists captured Adam Smith's deeply counterintuitive idea that some of the most important things, food, clothes, jobs, come not from anyone's good intentions, but instead from the invisible hand that leads self-interested people and businesses to provide them. After putting this question to the people of X, I was delighted to be drawn to The Lady's Paradise by the French writer Emile Zola. The novel is set in the first big department store in Paris, its bigness made possible by new technologies, like the elevator and steam engine, and new ideas about inventory management. The department store, a kind of anti-hero, squeezes out small businesses and seduces people into wanting unnecessary stuff with flashy ads and clever in-store displays. Customers, Zola writes, are subjugated and devoured. At the same time, the store benefits its patrons with a good selection at low prices. It also offers better pay, benefits, and professional advancement than the small businesses it is replacing, not because the owner of the department store is nice, in fact he is a serial sexual harasser, but because he has no choice given the competition for workers from other department stores. The book is also fun to read because of its protagonist, a resilient and resourceful woman who faces the perennial challenges of balancing work and family. The Absinthe Forger, a true story of deception, betrayal, and the world's most dangerous spirit, by Evan Rail. This review is by J.D. Beersdorfer. If you tasted an absinthe that was supposed to have been made a century or more ago, would you even know what to look for? Asks Evan Rail. It's a key question driving his new book. The Absinthe Forger, a true story of deception, betrayal, and the world's most dangerous spirit, which, along with the promised detective story, delivers a lively, standalone seminar on temptation, as well as the culture and history of the much maligned liquor, and its reputation for causing madness and murder. Nicknamed the Green Fairy for its most common hue, absinthe inspired Oscar Wilde, Vincent van Gogh, Henri Toulouse-Lautrec, Ernest Hemingway, and many other authors and artists who found in it a liquid muse, not to mention a general public who just liked to drink. The traditional French way of consuming the distinctive concoction, flavored with anise, fennel, and a type of wormwood called Artemisia absinthium, typically includes a ritual involving a specialized Art Nouveau-inspired accoutrement. The drinker opens up absinthe flavors with a dribble of ice water poured over a sugar cube, perched on a slotted spoon atop the glass. Absinthe was legally banned in the United States and parts of Europe for most of the 20th century, thanks to news media reports of lurid effects and unsound science concerning thujone, the chemical neurotoxin found in the wormwood. Pressure from rival winemakers wanting a bigger share of drinkers and temperance activists who wanted zero drinkers added fuel to the anti-absinthe fire. As for absinthe's reputation for inducing madness, today's science demonstrates that it likely wasn't the wormwood that made people trip out or act up, but rather the spirit's extremely high alcohol content. Still, many modern variations throttle back the thujone. Hardcore fans of the edgy emerald spirit consider those bottles of the stuff made before France's 1915 ban especially desirable. It's these absintheurs and their tightly knit subculture, including, naturally, Facebook groups, as well as input from modern distillers, that propel the narrative as Rail tries to contact the forger of the title, an alleged expert who was passing off modern mixtures as vintage spirits. So what might be found in this book for those in the low end of the absinthe appreciation spectrum, who say, once sampled it after seeing Moulin Rouge, in which the Green Fairy is played by Kylie Minogue, and are of the opinion that absinthe tastes like licorice-flavored mouthwash. Thankfully, the absinthe forger touches on much more than just an acquired taste for a ritualistically consumed spirit. I wanted to know more about the collector's mentality, what drove people to buy old bottles for thousands of dollars, as well as to try to understand why Christian, whoever he was, had done what he had done, Rail writes. The crimes of Christian, the London-based forger of the book's title, are revealed early. Rail's story is a larger one, that of the enthusiast's dedication to learning the history and the nature of obsession. As a Prague-based journalist and frequent New York Times contributor who regularly writes about alcohol, food, and travel, Rail clearly has the skill set needed to tell this story. He even once wrote a feature on absinthe for The Times. In his roaming research, he encounters a woman involved in the absinthe underground of gray market collectors who has a simple answer as to why someone would pay a premium for a dusty bottle of liquor that was sealed in a wall or buried in a cellar for a century. People buy pre-bans because they want to drink them, she tells Rail. They want to make it part of their lives, part of their own bodies. That physical desire to connect with the past may seem extreme, but it also plays as an elegy for the passing of a more civilized era, however idealized it may be. As Rail observes, I realized the world had lost its culture of drinking absinthe, so much so that most people didn't even know how to serve it, and connoisseurs themselves struggled to grasp how to use the equipment. The absinthe forger uses Christian's crime as a way to explore the spirit's world, but the book also feels like a time travel quest, one that means going deeply into obsessive collector mode. As one aficionado ironically reflects, in a way, absinthe really did lead to insanity. Our reviewer, J.D. Bierstorfer, is the production editor for the book review and writes the weekly interactive literary quiz, as well as the monthly tech tip column for The Times. No One Gets to Fall Apart, A Memoir, by Sarah Labrie. Reviewer, Linda Villarosa. In March 2017, Sarah Labrie, a TV writer living in Los Angeles, received a phone call from her grandmother, who unspooled an alarming thread of calamities, suggesting that Labrie's mother was suffering from severe mental illness. She had been found parked on the side of the freeway in Houston, the author's hometown, honking her horn, her car filled with notes in which she outlined federal agents' plans to kill her. These fears had been dogging her for a month, during which she sometimes slept in her car, not going inside to shower or change, the number of her imagined pursuers ballooning to the hundreds. After submerging her work computer in the bathtub, Labrie's mother had been fired from her job as a registered nurse. By the time of the phone call, her mother had returned home from the psychiatric hospital outside Houston, where she'd been drugged to sleep for 48 hours. She didn't remember any of it, Labrie's grandmother explained. Her mother was back to normal, looking for a new nursing job and blaming the diagnosis she received, severe depression, on Houston's traffic and the onset of menopause. In her affecting debut memoir, Labrie chronicles her mother's descent into what would eventually be diagnosed as schizophrenia, while also exploring the through line of mental illness that snakes through her family history. Her great-grandmother, Alma, whose own grandmother was enslaved, spent most of her time in bed and was likely depressed before anyone used the word, especially to describe a black woman. Labrie's violent and erratic grandfather may have been an undiagnosed schizophrenic. And in an inner monologue that reveals snippets of bizarre behavior, LaBrie also worries about her own tenuous grasp on emotional stability, imagining mental illness spreading its way through my mother and turning her into someone I don't recognize, and then making its way through her into me. If she compares her mother's disorder to drought in California, it could come and go and come and go and come back worse every time. The sudden fits of rage she remembers from her childhood are like Houston thunderstorms, which emerge fully formed out of what moments before appeared to be a cloudless sky. As her mother combs her hair one evening in their home on the same upscale street in Houston's Third Ward, where Beyoncé and Solange Knowles are also being raised, a childish joke sends her mother into a spiral of violence. She hits LaBrie and locks her in a closet, where the girl sits in a blanket of darkness, rolling two turquoise marbles between her fingers. An argument about dog food results in their three dogs' abandonment outside a strip mall. I watch the dogs through the side mirrors, chasing the car, trying to catch up, pink tongues lolling. LaBrie writes, back home, she tells me to take off my pants, bends me over the bathtub, and beats me with a belt until I finally start to cry. LaBrie escapes Texas to go to Brown, where she spends years desperately code-switching her way through predominantly white spaces that include a boozy college party where she is sexually assaulted, a creative writing fellowship at NYU, and an internship at The New Yorker. She struggles to write a novel about time travel called The Anatomy Book, which she describes as a tumor. But if I try to cut it out, she tells a friend, I'll die. Her mother's illness intrudes on her life throughout. Her text messages fill up my phone like dark poems. Her mother hears the voice of the former Houston Rocket Center, Hakeem Olajuwon, telling her she doesn't have to open the door to her social worker or take her meds. Despite the ever-mounting pile of evidence to the contrary, LaBrie and her loved ones continue to support one another's denial that her mother is sick. Black people don't go to therapy, her grandmother insists, buying her daughter some books on personal improvement instead. LaBrie's boyfriend, Ethan, blames her family's issues on bad luck and suggests she stop trying to predict the future, and his words become the title of this book. Her aunt Tina tells her mental illness didn't happen to people you knew. In LaBrie's hands, this grim and messy story feels both urgent and imaginative. Though she sometimes writes with the flattened tone of someone trying desperately to sound okay while beating back demons, this effect is overshadowed by her sharp observations of worlds she feels excluded from. In college, she and a black friend find a common enemy in the other girls studying literature with their shiny hair and eating disorders that make them look frail and breakable, like little brittle Joan Didion's in training. In adulthood, she thinks that following the literary world feels more and more like watching the fragile children of aristocrats gingerly explore their talents while their friends applaud and the world around them burns. No One Gets to Fall Apart makes for an engrossing read, its hectic scenes held together by a psychically unmoored narrator whose wit and honesty make us trust her anyway. The reviewer, Linda Villarosa, is a contributing writer for The Times magazine. Selling Sexy, Victoria's Secret and the Unraveling of an American Icon, by Lauren Sherman and Chantal Fernandez. Two veteran fashion journalists examine how Victoria's Secret fell from grace in this brisk, lively chronicle of the global retail empire built on sweet nothings, bits of lace, and rayon. But this is a book about bras in the same way that Citizen Kane is a movie about a sled, which is to say, not at all. It's really about business and the flawed thinking that can bring it down. Thank you for joining us for the New York Times Book Review, read by Nefeli Schneider.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777. 7777.